Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham, and this show is brought to you in association with, just checking with VAR, yep, oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it's been a mixed work week here on Planet Albion. First, last Saturday, a professional performance saw off a poor Watford side and saw to it that we would go to the midweek game at Old Trafford full of confidence. And so it proved, as our first half performance had everybody purring. However, the curse that hangs over Jakob Moda continues to haunt us as he was unable to take any of the gilt-edged chances that fell to him. And then a second half that saw United improve and seize on a rare Basuma mistake, followed by a controversial red card that saw us with a mountain to climb and saw us succumb to only our second defeat on the road this season. So then, a chance to put things right today as we welcome rock bottom Burnley to the Amex. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the first lady of the Roar. It's Vicky Rees. So, hello, guys. How are we all?
Vicky, did you know you were the first lady of the Roar?
No, but it's a small queue, isn't it? It's quite a low bar.
It's not that small, but...
Diplomacy would tell me that it is actually quite a large queue, but the point is that, if you want to be first, you are now First Lady of the Roar, like it or lump it, Vicky. Sorry about that.
If I am the First Lady, then I would just hope to be a bit more Michelle Obama and a bit less Melania Trump, if that's okay.
Yeah, I'll go along with that. That's absolutely fine by me. Anyway, how are you? How have you survived Eunice?
Well, I have, yeah. That's not a question I expected to be asked. Yes, I have. No, all the garden furniture has been retrieved. Went to get my hair cut this morning, and that was the bigger worry for me, walking out the hairdressers. And then, you know, there goes the money I just spent on it. But no, it's all good. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a storm unit. I mean, you expect it to be pushing a Zimmer frame, but having been out on the beach earlier, it was definitely not doing that. It was quite fierce.
You live down on Worthing Beach virtually, AD. I mean, how much of the beach has ended up in your garden?
Fortunately, not a lot, but the canoe did blow down the road a little bit, and it's been a little bit crazy. It's just really, really wild out there, and it did actually nearly take my legs away for a bit. But it's let's hope it subsides and we can get the game on tomorrow without Burnley having anything to blame.
Was your hair, AD? How was your hair in the wind?
It's beautiful, Vix, and it is quite resplendent. I polished it specially for you. And
I'm just thinking of all that salt water that now lines every follicle that's left.
Yeah, well, the dogs had that as well. But anyway, moving swiftly on, it's been a mixed week. I mean, performance-wise, actually, the performance at Man United was probably better than it was at Watford. But, I mean, it was a last Saturday, 2-0 win, a professional job, Vix.
Yeah, I thought, functional is one word for it. In the first half was quite classically Albion in that we had a lot of the ball. But, yes, we actually did create some chances. Ben Foster saved a couple. But, it was a bit more functional than flair, wasn't it? A lot of sort of passing around the back, keeping the ball. And then I thought, okay, are we going to end up paying for this? But then Morpay got another beauty. I love Neil Morpay. Did I mention that last time? he got another little beauty just before half time. And I think most of us didn't quite realise it had gone in until they'd almost run off. Normally you have an inkling, don't you? You see the ball going and you're like, go on. And then, but that one, I think we're all, I think including Ben Foster, none of us were kind of quite sure. And
I mean, I think there's certainly an element of shin involved in that. But
if he'd have caught it with his laces, it would have been in the crowd.
Yeah, probably. But I mean, on the way up there, we were talking and said to you exactly how the game was going to pan out and what Watford were going to do. And unusually, I was right.
I was about to say, it was quite frightening how accurate you're, not so much at the Albion's play, but how accurate you are about Watford's play. I mean, what you've got up there, and you can do a direct compare and contrast with Crystal Palace here. I mean, it's Roy Hodgson's first game, or his first home game.
Yeah.
And you know, he clearly has an inferior set of players to work with, and he could only, I suppose, when he pitted his teams against Graham Potter, he never lost previously. So to do that now, and you realise that actually what he's doing is just setting Watford up not to lose, you get to realise just how unprepared still that yo-yo club is. And I mean yo-yo obviously just in terms of promotion, relegation, without actually really properly getting the house in order. They're getting through the managers like Billio, like Elizabeth Taylor got through Husbands, and they are not set up to be anything other than Premier League relegation fodder every other season, because obviously they're a top championship side. So yeah, they're set up two banks of four, conceded the widths as best they could, which for Lamptey or Cucurella is a dangerous thing to do. And I think that, you know, there were times when, as much as we were passing it round the back nicely, it was a bit lucky if we got through. And with the goal itself, it's because that the system had changed, dragging everyone over to the left a bit, isolating Lamptey against his fullback, and that gave him then the opportunity and time to cross and find someone rather than just hump it in there.
Yeah. I mean, Vicky, the fanfare that announced Roy for his first game at Vicky was right. I mean, how many times do they must be bored of that. I mean, they do it about five times a season, don't they?
Well, yeah. I went into that game. I wouldn't say I was hugely confident. I thought, this is going to be one of those annoying ones where we sort of have a lot of possession and end up drawing with a team that isn't much cop. And history has shown that we have struggled against Roy Ball previously. So yeah, it didn't really strike you as much of a party atmosphere for the Watford fans, did it? I thought the applause for Ray Lewington sounded louder than it did for poor old Roy. The only thing I did wonder with him was that even when he went to Palace, it did take him probably seven or eight games to actually start turning them around. And I don't think Watford have that kind of time. So as Al said, you know, he set them up, the banks are full, but they were very, very narrow and they were all in a sort of corridor down the centre, which gave us the width there. And I think once we sort of worked that out in the second half, this is what I like about Potter. He does seem to have the ability to respond to situations. You know, I did go in at half time thinking, OK, well, we've got that goal, brilliant, which was a slight, almost like a bonus, really, wasn't it? And I think... But we kind of went in... Well, I certainly, when I went in, I thought, OK, I'm quite reasonably confident here that Potter will come up with a solution or help the players come up with solutions, if you like. And that's what they did. You know, Watford came out at the start of the second half, had a little bit of a spell, which they have to. They're the home team. After that, they looked ragged. For the last 20 minutes of that game, they looked absolutely ragged and you never, ever felt that they were going to score.
Well, yeah, I mean, they brought Sarr on, they hit the bar, and then just as they were starting to get a foothold in the game, Potter brought Bissouma and McAllister on.
Oh, I thought McAllister was brilliant. I mean, Bissouma also, that kind of goes without saying, although I didn't think he was that great at Old Trafford, but certainly against Watford, he came on, got the game by the scruff of the neck. But I thought McAllister was outstanding when he came on. Some of the passes he was just flicking about. And he's a lot stronger than you think he's going to be. He's not some Latino, you know, pretty player that just doesn't like being challenged. He gets stuck in. He's not a big guy either, and he gets really stuck into some of these challenges.
Tigerish.
He's not getting pushed off the ball now, and I think that's the result of him having had that season to bed in, isn't it? He's kind of got used to English football now, for want of a, you know, that's a bit of a cliche, but he's got used to it, and I thought he was great when he came on. He was really good.
Absolutely. And along those lines, I think probably the point that's being raised there, and this is where I'd actually sort of offer huge praise for one of our players who seems to play brilliantly week in, week out, is when you get a player who's coming from a different culture, a different language, different continent even, and they take that time to bed in. And you know, some of the impatient fans who are kind of saying, you know, oh, this player's rubbish, they're not going to do this, they're not going to be able to do that, they're lightweight, they're this. And it takes that time. But the person who bedded in straight away is Mark Cucurella. Apart from getting clattered in the first 10 minutes at Brentford, which Lewis Dunk has famously said, instead of, you know, going over to him, instead of saying, "You're right, mate," or "Hang on, mate, that was out of order," he said, "Welcome to England, pal." And Cucurella has has not had to have that season transition. But the fact that McAllister has had that season transition, I think actually makes for him being a better player, plus with the experience of playing in the top division in England. And as such, as you say, Vicky, has kind of basically learned his lesson, which makes it all the more surprising, I think. Although, again, we're talking about a sort of rotation system here. It makes it a little bit more surprising. He doesn't start each game.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's quite easy to underestimate the impact on a move. That, I mean, if you look at, so McAllister was, 20, I think, when we brought him over. And he also came over in the, you know, the start of the first lockdown of where it was. I've lost track now. You know, he's 20 years old. He's not married. He's got no kids. He's not got, you know, I think he brought his girlfriend, but that's about it. But at 20 years old, to actually up sticks, move to the other side of the world where you don't really speak the language, you don't know anybody. We have this expectation, don't we, that these players are going to just up sticks, move, slot straight in. It's the same with Caicedo, isn't it? He's even younger. He's a lower profile as well from a lesser footballing country, if that's a fair thing to say. And, you know, suddenly, is that 19? That is actually very young to be, you know, moving. And I think it's no surprise that they take time. But what's, I think, is nice about the club at the moment is that they do seem to have this very forward-thinking strategy. And yes, sometimes it's frustrating when we bring players in and then they get loaned out or they get eased in very gently. But in the long term, it's exciting. It's really exciting with some of the players they've got waiting in the wings, you know, for next season when Basuma does go or when someone else goes. It's frustrating, but also exciting. So.
Yeah, I mean, it is nice that we have that environment for these players to come in where we don't expect them to hit the ground running.
And that's the point, isn't it, Adi? Some do.
I think this is where we all need to, and
I think probably most of us have, but this is where we all need to understand. I suppose probably the further away they're from, as a rule of thumb, the further away they're from, the more time you've got to allow them to have that bedding in. And when I said there's the language barrier, there's the distance barrier, there's the culture change to happen. I mean, if you've got someone coming in from Belgium who is Belgian, then the culture shock is not going to be so different, apart from the game itself being more physical. But if you've got someone coming in from Argentina who, all right, he's being seen as the... he's also got the burden of being the follow-up to Lionel Messi as Argentina's number 10. Now, there's some big boots to fill.
Yeah, well, it takes a bit of penalty.
It's completely accurate, Al. I have every faith.
But I mean, there's a thing, though. I mean, a lot of the expectation does come from the stands, and that's understandable to a certain degree because, you know, we've been desperate for... Everyone's been wanting this striker for years, it seems. And, you know, we sign a striker and we loan them out. I mean, obviously, we'll see what Undav brings to the party next year. But it's like with these...
Don't forget, his nickname's been chosen now, hasn't it?
Rodney!
No! No, it's you stand alone with Rodney, believe me. You and you alone. We know it's Chaz.
Oh, his Chaz and Dove.
Chaz and Dove. You know... So, yeah, I mean, and then the other thing is that Undav is basically a Mope type striker who looks like Mope. So, you know, as much as Vicky loves Neil Mope, she's going to have a choice of two next year to love and appreciate. And it's a bit like when Liverpool brought in John Aldridge looking like Ian Rush.
Yeah, I'd probably call him Lewis Dunk, probably. But
yes, please do.
You're falling. But okay, I mean, it was like, but I mean, we talked about the professional performance up there. But I mean, Morpé did score that goal, which he shinned in.
Yes, he did.
I don't think you can quite.
I mean, it was a let's call it a controlled finish off the shin. It looked better than it was. But Alan, it was a goal that brought him level with Glenn Murray as our Premier League top scorer.
You know that stat is meaningless, don't you?
Yes, I didn't say top flight. I said Premier League.
Well, in that case, don't mention it.
But he's got some way to go to catch up Robbo. But Glenn was probably loved more by the fans. Is that fair to say? And so, and the fact that Neil's done it, it's kind of happened a little bit on the quiet?
I don't think it's happened on the quiet. I think it's, you know, Morpay's another one that's, you know, I think, you know, the manager is looking after him really well. And that's what Potter seems to do well with the players, is that he's, you know, he's not damning them when they have a quiet game, shall we say. You know, he's not writing people. As a striker, unfortunately, that's the way it goes sometimes, isn't it? You're on a, you know, when Lallana misses four chances, as you know, he regularly does, no one's, you know, that's not his business, is it? But, you know, no one's necessarily criticising Lallana for missing sitters, whereas, you know, when Morpay does it, of course, I understand that is what he's paid to do, but, you know, he's still learning. Morpay's still not that experienced in Premier League levels. He's actually doing better than Watkins is this season, which I think, you know, people still gone about Watkins being an England candidate. I'm not suggesting Morpay is an England candidate, by the way.
But he's just declared for Argentina, apparently.
Oh, I'd quite like that. That would be good. We can just have them all playing around Messi. That would be good.
Around McAllister.
Well, yeah, but I'm Morpay and McAllister playing around Messi. That's,
oh, I see, yeah.
Not going on there. That would be good. That would make me watch the Copa America. But I think... But yeah, that Morpay is a confidence player, but I think at the moment he's feeling good about himself, because suddenly, and I know it just stems from the Palace game, but why the hell not? Suddenly every game he's got people singing his name. You know, the whole of last season he went without A, any crowds there at all, and B, you know, anybody singing anybody's name. Whereas actually at the Watford game there was so much you know, support from the away fans. I mean, there's barely a player on the pitch that didn't have a song sung about them at some point. Some of them, one or two I obviously can't repeat on here, but
yes,
you know, that they are it must be nice for him. I think he's the sort of player that will thrive on that kind of admiration from the crowd, just like he thrives on abuse from the opposition fans. You know what he's like. That's why they call him Le Petit Outhouse.
Yes. Well, the thing is, he is as much of a bête noire to Arsenal fans as Wolf is to us. I mean, for actually a Brighton player to be on the Arsenal fans' radar, and think of just how delusional they are. So, you know, I imagine he has a good time playing against Arsenal and playing, going up against Ben White. Well, obviously, he's done it once this season, but going up against Arsenal, I'd imagine he has a great time. But in answer to your question, Adi, about sort of the whole notion of the Glenn Murray versus Neil Morpay, I think you are dealing with apples and oranges here, pomme orange, because Glenn's career with the Albion is so much more colourful. You know, he started off with this sort of surly, miserable, well, let's remember what Gary Dicker called him on the Albion Raw, but, you know, and ends up his last season, first time round, being leading scorer in a promotion year, goes off to Crystal Palace, becomes the great unforgiven, eventually ends up at Reading and Bournemouth and other non-entities, and comes back here. And even then has to take a little bit of time to win back some people whose memories are painfully long, and then goes and is the top scorer again in another promotion season. And I don't think anyone's ever achieved that for the Albion. And then goes on and is the top scorer in the top division for Brighton. So, you know, we're talking about so much more of a colourful career, but yeah, Neil Morpay has it within him, should he so wish, to knuckle down and become the legend that he could, you know, he has it within him to be. If he knocks in 10 to 12 goals a season over the next 7 or 8 years, there's nearly 100 goals in the Premier League for him. That's no mean feat for a little team with hashtag team like Brighton.
True. Okay, well, I mean, we left the Vicarage Road with a 2-0 victory. It was Adam Webster who got the second eventually.
Can I just say, if that was the other way around, I would be screaming blue murder at our defence, because he had two bites at the cherry and no one went to close him down.
Well, he was free.
Well, quite. As a piece of defending, it was abysmal. Absolutely abysmal. But, you know, that's not our problem, because, you know, it wasn't at our end. So, great. But
I mean, I did like the interview with Lewis Dunk afterwards, where he basically said, yeah, that's it. He scored it eventually. But, you know, it's that's two for him now. I better get on the end of something soon, don't I?
And like, well, yes, Lewis, actually it is, frankly.
But we'll be talking about Lewis very shortly. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And we have another shirt of the week for your delight. Obviously, check that out, obviously, on oldfootballshirts.com and also on our social media. But I mean, Vicky, do you want to have a go at describing this one for us?
Well, yeah, I'm going to be honest. I kind of vaguely recognised it when you showed it to me. So I don't know if I'm on the right line or not. But it looks to me like a royal blue shirt. It's a Hummel shirt and it's got the sponsor's name of Rémy Picot on it, which does kind of sound a bit French, but I don't think it's a French shirt.
Really?
Okay, what do you reckon?
Well, I think it's Spanish, Shady, because I think it's an away shirt. But
okay, keep going.
The only thing that's confusing me is the badge, because the badge is not the team I was expecting it to be. So, yeah.
Well, who are you expecting it to be with based on the rest of the shirt?
Well, I remember in the kind of the player that springs to mind in my head is from the kind of Butragueño era at Real Madrid, because they used to have like a white shirt with purple on it that was like that. I can't know. I'm not entirely sure on the sponsor, but it's like that, and Hugo Sanchez, that kind of player.
We have a winner for the big first prize.
Can I just point out also?
You are absolutely 100% correct.
Aidy, can I just also point out, because Phil will not forgive us if we don't mention it, that it's made by his favourite Hummel kit manufacturer.
Actually, Hummel, there's some brilliant new shirts that have just appeared on there. There's a Scandinavian style, I can't remember which one. They've got a brilliant shirt. I'm sure we'll be having that one in the next few weeks, actually. But it was really, really nice. But Hummel, yeah, they make some good kits historically as well. But I mean, this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. Here is your shirt of the week, chosen because it was posted onto oldfootballshirts.com this week. And the sponsor made me curious. This is the 1989 to 1990 away shirt of former European Super League side Real Madrid. The club was formed in 1902 and they play at the 81,044 capacity Estadio Santiago Bernabéu in the northern part of Madrid. The origins of the club can be traced back to 1897 at the Institución Libre de Onsenaza, an education project in Madrid, which included several Oxford and Cambridge graduates. They formed a football team, originally called Sociedad Sky Football, and then Nueva Sociedad de Football. And then, as the team gathered momentum in 1901, the club was renamed Madrid Football Club and entered to the Spanish League. After three seasons, they won the league and in 1909 became founder members of the Royal Spanish Football Federation. And in 1920, King Alfonso VIII granted them the title Real, which means royal, as we probably know, and they became Real Madrid. 34 La Liga titles have ensued, making them the all-time kings of the Spanish Monkey Tennis League. Thank you, Phil. By a country mile. Barcelona have only won the league 26 times. 33 cups and 19 European cups means that they are among the most decorated teams in the world. That said, they are eclipsed by the Giants of Glasgow. Rangers have 55 league titles and 61 domestic cups. Even Celtic have 51 league titles and 60 domestic cups. I don't see that Madrid will be ever overtaking them unless they form some sort of super league. Anyway, back to the sponsors. Rémy Picot are a Spanish cheese brand and they are owned by Asturianas. And they are popular the world over. Links to the UK are many and varied, but links to the Albion, well, here you go. Former forward Jack Harper. He spent much of his youth career at Madrid before finishing his youth career at Brighton, but he never made the step up. or a first team appearance. And he went back to Spain and he joined Malaga in 2017. There you go. I think that's about it. Nice shirt, though, says Phil. And actually, Phil, we're looking forward to your new shirt after your new site, sorry, after the relevations last week. But all the players have personalized socks. So we're looking forward to oldfootballsocks.com starting in the next few weeks.
Can I just point out that one of the reasons why Madrid and or Barcelona won't ever beat Rangers or Celtic's record is frankly is because the Scottish League started about 30, 35 years before the Spanish League did. So they got quite a head start on them.
What, are they shooting fish in a barrel?
And also because Real Madrid aren't playing Raith Rovers every week.
Well, there is that. There is that. Have you ever been to the... have you two been to the Bernabeu?
No, I've not been to Madrid.
Yeah, I've been to a game there. I saw Madrid against Roma in the Champions League, where Madrid were absolutely abysmal. And of all people, Francesco Totti ran them ragged. But I've also done the stadium tour as well. And that's a bizarre thing. You go up in a... I suppose it's probably most modern stadiums have them now, but for me, it was the first club that had them. Because the block that they're on means that the... and then the main roads around it mean that the terraces or the seating is quite high. The banking is quite steep, relatively steep, certainly in comparison to, say, the Nou Camp. So you have to take a lift up to the top floor, and it is a long, long way up. But in talking about the royal, you know, patronage that they have, there is actually something there called the King's Chair, which is essentially set sort of remarkably low. Its vantage point is not brilliant. But yeah, there is the King's Chair there, you know, sort of just ordinating the club's royal patronage.
Yeah. Anyway, Al, we do have a notice board this week, and there has been an announcement from the RENF.
From the Robert Eaton Memorial Fund, yes. This will be the 20th Robert Eaton Memorial Fund challenge match between Brighton fans and Crystal Palace fans. And we're delighted to say that this time, for the first time, or the second time of giving it a go, since we had to postpone it from 2 years ago, this will be a two-legged affair. The reason we've been asked to do this is it's in consideration to the Palace lads who've given so much time and effort towards the match. And they said, look, can we have a game up there? So I said, well, let's have a two-legged affair. So Friday the 29th of April at Croydon FC, it's the Croydon Sports Arena, 7:45 kickoff is the first leg, Crystal Palace fans against Brighton fans. To get there, especially if you're coming from the Sussex coast or from the south, is you get the train to East Croydon, and you can get that from pretty much everywhere around here, and then you jump off and then you go onto the tram, which is six stops, which takes you to a stop called Arena, which is right there. And we're talking about as if, for those who went to With Dean, as if the arena stop was where the tunnel near With Dean is, and that it's that close. So it's right there. So that's the first game. And the second game will be at Sussex FA headquarters, Culver Road, Lancing. Again, just a few minutes walk from a railway station, Lancing Railway Station in this instance. And that will be on Friday the 20th of May, 7:45 kickoff. A fiver for everyone to get in, £2 for under 16s, free if you're accompanied by an adult. You can pay cash or card. We've got a little plip machine that you can enter the stadium by, either stadium by. So if you feel like coming along, please do show your support. It'd be great to see you all there. We'd like to see some great numbers there, frankly, because we promised Lancing that the Sussex FA that already. So it'd be nice if you could come along. By the way, the chips at Sussex FA are absolutely superb, Adi, are they not?
They're all right. The Bovril is very, very good, I seem to remember from my time there. And we also have some other news as well. I mean, to be honest, you'll find this anywhere that the Albion have released anything. But the Spurs game's finally been rearranged. And that will be on Wednesday, the 16th of March, with kickoff at 7:30. Okay, well, back to that little comment that Phil put on the shirt of the week there about Jack Harper, who is a player I've completely and utterly forgotten about. He was meant to be, you know, when we signed him from Real Madrid, he was, I mean, that was a long time ago. And this shows you how far the club's progressed since then. But, you know, he was meant to be, oh, we got this player from Real Madrid. He's really highly rated. And it just never really quite happened for him. He had skill in abundance. We saw that from the rare performances that we did see from him. But he never made a first team appearance.
Well, I think it's just considered that. I think we all got excited by the fact that it was a sexy signing. You know, we're signing a kid, a British kid from Real Madrid. I think we're all sort of caught in the headlights of the glamour of it, really. But above and beyond that, you know, I suppose it doesn't even matter whose academy you go through. It's far from definite, even though you're going to have the best footballing education, it's far from definite you're going to actually make it into the top division. So, yeah, it sounded like a sexy thing at the time, but in the great scheme of things, if the fella, you know, can't cut it. Did you say he's at Malaga now?
Well, that's where he went after us. I mean, that was only in 2017. So, I mean, you know, when you look at the leaps and bounds, particularly with the way that the academy is run now and the pathway that we have now, you would like to think that he might have been given more of an opportunity, maybe back then.
Not really. No, if he's good enough, he's good enough. It's down to him. It's not, you know, I'm sure that once in a while that the club has let go an absolute doozy. But actually, off the top of my head, I can't think of anyone. Someone who has actually left the academy and gone to have a stellar career. Vix, does anyone spring to mind with you?
Not really. And I think that's the legacy of where we have been over the years, isn't it? That we've produced very few players that have gone on to be brilliant. You know, there's been enough over the years that have gone on, you know, and had perfectly acceptable careers, championship sort of level. You know, I wouldn't want to be detrimental to someone like Steve Cook or Tommy Elphick because they did a job there. But historically, I think this is the first time in I was going to say our history, but the history that I remember in sort of 30 years plus. Oh, my God, that makes me feel old. 30 years plus of watching.
You're not, don't worry.
I'm the youngest on this show. That makes me feel good.
Thanks, Vix.
In all of that time, we have never been a club who other clubs are circling thinking, I want that player, I want that player, I'd like to look at this player. This is the first time in our recent, well, not even recent, but in most of our history where we've got several players that are drawing envious glances. We've never had that before. You might have the odd player, you know, Zamora in his time, bigger clubs than us were looking at him, but not in terms of the, you know, someone like a Joao as well, I suppose, but it was never really top clubs. It was never multiple players. If we look at the team now, we know Bissouma will go in the summer. There's no doubt in my mind that that will happen. He might not necessarily end up at a massive club. He might end up getting stuffed with Aston Villa, but, you know, he will move somewhere for reasonable money because of the contract situation. You know, you've got Lamptey, without a doubt. Other clubs will be looking at Lamptey. There's others in that squad that actually interest other clubs now. And that's actually, it's brilliant. And as long as we've got that conveyor belt going, and this is what I was saying about bedding these younger players in and the newer players in and giving them time. And actually, you know, there's a lot of forward thinking by the club there. And by the way, Jack Harper's playing for Racing Santander on loan from Getafe after numerous other loans because he's clearly not that good.
There we go. But in regards to that, Vicky, I mean, you mentioned the succession planning that we've got. I mean, the fact that we've got Bissouma, we don't want him to go, quite clearly, and we'd love him to sign another contract and stay here for the rest of his career. But that's not going to happen. I think the club would like to have his best interests at heart and would only sell him to a club that is in a better position than we are. And I don't think Aston Villa are necessarily that club at the moment. With the backing they've got, they could be going forward. But I mean, you know, we signed Kashido, we signed Enoch Mwepu, who are in that similar sort of vein. The succession planning is there. And obviously with the other Dan going possibly to Newcastle, Do we see that as a problem, or do we see the fact that we got succession planning for him as well?
I think they will, because they've said all along. I can't remember when or where I read it, but there was an interview. It was probably an interview with Ashworth, but I think it was Paul Barber, and they've said all along that they have. Yeah, it's easy for us to think when a club loses a manager, now we've got to start looking for someone else. And in some cases, you know, certainly when Spurs fire a manager, that seems to be what they do. They sit there and they think, oh, now we've got to go and find someone. But I'm sure it was Paul Barber that said, we've always got a shortlist. When Potter goes, they've already, you know, they keep a constant shortlist of people, whether it's for the manager, whether it's, you know, they must have known that it was a possibility that Ashworth would go. I know there's talk now Newcastle are trying to get John Morling to go over, and I don't know how much of a role he plays, you know, in the overall scheme of things.
If John Morling went, that would be catastrophic.
I don't think it would be catastrophic, Aidy, because this is football, isn't it? This is what we do. It's evolutionary, and this is the whole point that what I'm saying is, and what Paul Barber said, is that the club do have this. They've always got shortlists, whether it's for players or for backroom staff or for, you know, senior staff in the club, there is always someone there. Yeah, who knows? Maybe someone will come along and call Barber at some point. I hope they've got a lot of money.
But I mean, we've had John Morling on the show twice, and I mean, his impact and what he's done with the club is very unsung. But I mean, he's put that pathway in place a long time before Dan Ashworth arrived.
Well, yeah, but I think that the point you're making, I think catastrophic is too strong a word. Because we have, and this is the point that Vicky's making, is that we have the next person lined up. If John Morling was to go tomorrow, that's not, yes, it would be big boots to fill. Yes, the work he has done, especially bringing it up from pre-Lancing training ground to what it is now, and being at the head of this, the umbrella of everything. The work he's done is astonishing. But because the work is there and because the system is there, the system that he himself may or may not have written, or he has been a major part of doing, it's there ready for the next person who is going to be appropriate enough to then fit into his shoes. You know, we're talking about maybe David Weir taking on Dan Ashworth's role. Is the fella ready? Is he prepared to do it? We don't know. But the point is that there is a possible ready-made replacement.
And we already know there's been a high-level applicant for that.
Graham Potter was to go, then the next person is almost certainly being identified, and so on and so forth. And we've got it with the playing staff as well. So if we have someone who we see is irreplaceable, or we're going to struggle to fill those boots, and I do think that with Bissouma, his talent is that high, that the players that you mention for me aren't there yet. If we're talking about Mwepu, if we're talking about Acasiedo, if we're talking about even McAllister filling those boots, Lallana is on side two, track three of his career. Yes. So he's going to get to the end notes sooner rather than later. He's probably only got maybe 2 or 3 years left of his career.
You've also got Alzate as well.
And we've got Alzate. So we've got all these players. Now, you know, if it was a combined thing, then between Alzate, between Mwepu and between Gasedo, we've probably got something, you know, that will fill the talent that Bissouma has. But then there is something extra. There is that missing link, that bit of magic that actually we are appreciating now. And we've got to acknowledge that we are actually watching one of the great players of the Albion's history.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, he's, of course, he's replaceable, but the point is that he does the job of about two or three players. Can I also make go on to a point that Vicky is making about, you know, the selling of players in her lifetime, is that the last time this really happened, i.e. with players that were going to, I suppose, clubs bigger than ours, was 40, 45 years ago. And we're thinking of Mark Lawrenson and Michael Robinson going to Liverpool. We're thinking of Gary Stevens going to Spurs. This is the last time it really happened. And it's, I think, indicative of the club's position that we can actually have these players who are good enough to go to and demand as what we would call a big money transfer.
Well, Al, this would be a really good time to bring in Mark Lawrenson, but we can't because his phone broke. But he would have done.
It reminds me of someone who looks like technology was always going to pass him by.
Yeah, this is true. But it brings us nicely on to this Tuesday night's game at Old Trafford. Only our second defeat on the road this season, which is brilliant, to be honest. For the Albion to be in that sort of position, really. But it's like, it should have been so much more. It promised so much more, Vicky. And that first half performance, I mean, we should have been going in 2-3 goals ahead at that half time in that game. And what is this curse over Jakub Moda? It means he can't score in the Premier League.
I don't know. Well, I mean, he's obviously, you know, had a good settling in period with the Albion now and had any kind of scoring ability knocked out of him. But it's just frustrating, isn't it? Because I don't even think it's just the curse on Moda, is it? It just feels like there's a bit of a curse on us as far as Man United are concerned. And yeah, you know, I'm not going to lie, I'm still angry about the Bruno Fernandes penalty at the home game a couple of years ago. I still haven't quite got over that.
Mind him.
I take you that, and I raise you the fact that Harry Maguire didn't get sent off for bringing down Danny Welbeck in the area, which would have given us a 2-0 lead there last season.
Like, do you know what? It's sort of almost like, right, the referee's on the pitch, he's made a decision. And that was what was slightly annoying, is that he makes a decision. So, yes, it's a foul, and yes, I'm going to book you. So, you know, he's decided that's the situation here. And then, obviously, I believe it was Jared Gillett sitting there in the box going, mate, you might want to go and have a look at this. You know, it's Manchester United, right? And so he goes over and looks at it and suddenly decides that it's a worse foul and that it's a more significant foul. He saw it in the first place. It's one of these ones, isn't it? He saw it happen. It wasn't like one that he missed, or it was a much, much worse tackle. That the crushing inevitability that was going to happen at Old Trafford. You know, watching the last three games, I'm not convinced Dunk's quite up to speed yet anyway. I didn't think he was...
No, which has left...
He had a bit of a horror game at Spurs. He looked very, very rusty. And now he's got another game to miss, you know. You just know. The only thing that's surprising is that the FA have charged Man United players for hassling the referee. And some of their fans, I've even seen them on Twitter go, how can you charge our players? They were right. That's not really the point, is it? It's just classic Man United, hound the referee.
Well, the thing is, when you look at the stills of the ref looking at the screen, I can't say exactly what he was being shown, but they do show it from behind. The pictures that he was looking for did not show Adam Webster in any of them. No. And that was the mitigating factor. And you and I don't even, we're not even convinced it was actually a foul, but it was...
Well, he made a meal of it. The player certainly made a meal of it. He saw an opportunity. And maybe he didn't back himself because he thought maybe Webster was on the cover. When I first saw it, my initial thought was, it's, you know, Dogso, which is a great name, you know, denying an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. Because I thought in my mind's eye that the ball went straighter. In other words, more towards Sanchez than it did. Then I saw the replay and it was more towards Webster. Now, I don't know what was going through the referee's mind when he booked him, when he thought, as in, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But then Vicky points out it is Old Trafford. You know, there are different rules for playing when you're playing against Manchester United. Let's look at their wonderful tactic of persistent fouling, niggly fouling, and take it in terms to, well, how many times did they take it in turns like Watford did to foul Tarik Lamptey? Luke Shaw was very, very lucky to be on the pitch at the end there, because, you know, but that is whataboutery. So let's move on from that. Could Adam Webster have got across? I think that there is enough doubt there to have actually said, yes, he could have. I'm not convinced he would. So if the red card had been given immediately, you would be able to see why. And the Albion's right to challenge would, I think, have been a lot harsher. Because at the end of the day, we have to remind ourselves, it's in the opinion of the referee. That is the law. It's in the opinion.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, and I probably am.
Happily.
If the ref had given a red card straight away, would VAR have reviewed that?
Yes. So they review, that's one of the four things that VAR reviews, is the red card thing, and what then the referee and VAR between, or whoever it is between them, have to then ascertain that with that original decision that they've made a clear and obvious error in order for it to be changed.
Yeah.
And I would say, my opinion would be, is if the thing is, whether it's a yellow card or a red card, there is no clear or obvious error. So a yellow card, go with it, stick with it. If it's red card, and I would have been satisfied in terms of, you know, the way that the game was refereed, I'd have been satisfied if it was considered a straight red straight away. Let's say it wouldn't have been a clear and obvious error to take it down to a yellow, in my opinion.
But Vicky, I mean, I'm talking about this incident and all the other incidents that are similar that have happened this season where the ref has gone over to the monitor, and none of them has the refs had the balls to stand up to the VAR and said, no, I'm standing by my original decision. None of them.
I think that's only happened twice, though. If memory serves me correctly, there's only been two occasions ever since VAR's been a thing. There has only been two occasions when referees have been called over and they've looked at the monitor and they've gone, no, I'm sticking with it. And one of them went in our favour.
Yep.
One of them was involving Jack Grealish at Villa Park. And the decision, yeah, he sort of made the decision. I can't remember whether did he give the penalty? Whatever it was, it went in our favour and the referee stuck with his original. And it was just one of those. So it happens very rarely. And so you know what's going to happen. The referee, it's almost like they haven't got the guts to, you know, someone sits in an office and watches that game and then says, yeah, have a little look at that. And it's almost like they haven't got the guts to stand up to them and go, actually, no, do you know what? I'm happy with what I've given. I'm happy with that. It's like someone else is telling me, watching the same thing that I'm watching, someone else is telling me I'm wrong. I mustn't question another referee.
Sure. The one thing I that I would say, actually, when you're talking about when the referee goes over to his monitor and it's benefited us, I actually thought you were going to mention the game. It was actually when there might have been a one against Villa. I don't recall, but I'll take your word for it. But the one I was going to mention was when we scored at Spurs, when I think there was consideration that Solly Marks fouled one of their players in the build-up before Lamptey scored. The referee was asked to go over to the monitor and he just shrugged his shoulders and said, no, I'm okay with that. And the goal for Brighton stood. And this was either one or two seasons ago.
That's the only time last season. It was Tarek Lamptey, so it would have been last season. But
yeah.
Okay. So, well, I mean, look, we can keep going on about this until it blows in the face. I mean, it's a frustrating decision for us. It means we lose Lewis for another game, and I think that must be a record, actually, a ninth red card in his Albion career, which is a lot.
Does this mean that you can go back to Adam Virgo and say you're not, you know? You're the bridesmaid now.
Adam Virgo only got six, so it was...
Really? I thought you were happy, more than happy to tell him he was our all-time leading red carder.
Well, we did at the time, and then we realised that Ian Chapman got more, but it was...
and so did Gary Hart.
Well, like, he didn't get more than Chappers. But anyway, let's move on from red card frustration to what was actually a brilliant performance from us, even with 10 men, actually.
I think it was in patches, wasn't it? I think the first half was excellent. I don't want to get too caught up with the red card because ultimately we didn't quite do what we needed to win that game. And, you know, you can always sit there and question referees. And I try not to sort of pile too much blame on them, apart from with Kevin Friend. But that, don't get me started on that before the weekend. But
is he up this weekend?
Yeah, I believe he is. Kevin, that's my problem, you see. I'm going to do it, aren't I? Kevin, Friend of the big clubs, which is going to be interesting because I don't know what he's going to do when you've got two clubs who, by nobody's definition, are big clubs, or at this level anyway. Yeah. So I don't know quite how this is going to pan out. But yeah, I think we played really well in the first half, completely outplayed them. Second half, as again, you would expect, they're the home team. They've got to have some sort of ass kicking from the manager, even though they've been shambles lately. And obviously when, you know, Princess Ronaldo comes out and does his thing, and, you know, we weren't quite as organised at the start of that second half, were we? And did we lose the game because of the red card? No, we didn't. It didn't help when you're trying to get back into it. But I think we dipped a little bit, didn't we, in the second half? And they do have quality players, you know, whether they clearly haven't been playing very well. The annoyance for me is just because I think we've kind of almost got to a point where they've been playing crap, we've been playing quite well. You know, we fancy ourselves a bit now, and it's almost I'm going to be that person and say it. I'm going to say it, you know, on form that we're on, we should be beating teams like Man United.
But can I just say, Vicky, you
went listening to that game optimistically, Alan. Now I'm like, damn it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've got it written down here. I mean, we went into the game with no fear, and because we've gone to Anfield, we've gone to Chelsea, and like, you know, these teams don't hold any fear. We've given them a game, and we didn't win. Well,
I think probably with the exception of Man City, and I know that we have beaten them, but let's face it, A, it was after they won the championship, and B, they just hit the petulant button. And it was a great win, absolutely. But I still think that, you know, City is the one team, and I'm thinking we struggle to give them a game. They, you know, they went down to 10 men and then lost it. But with Chelsea, with Arsenal, with Spurs, we can give them a game. With Liverpool, you know, all of those lot, we can give them a game. So until sort of stones, we know we can't beat Manchester City, we're not going to win the title, which is, you know, quite upsetting, really. But I wanted to bring you back to something that you were doing, Vicky, on Tuesday with the Manchester United game. I understand you were listening on BBC Sussex, which admittedly is a mildly biased.
No, it was on Five Live, I believe.
But it was probably the only one biased in favour of the Albion, because let's face it, the rest of commentary. And I don't know what you've heard, but embarrassingly stilted towards, well, in this case, one of the big six sides, isn't it?
Yeah, that's kind of par for the course, though, isn't it? I guess, you know, when you've got, 20 million lifelong, passionate, match day attending supporters all over the globe, then that's the audience they pander to, isn't it? It's no different, really, to when they're in the Championship, Sky used to put Leeds on, because that's what they know, that's the audience, isn't it? They know they're going to get that audience, so of course they're going to talk about it. And, you know, it is big news if Ronaldo happens to be on the bench, or he's got a new haircut, or any of these type of players, whether it's Mo Salah or, you know, someone from Chelsea, whoever. Unfortunately, it's par for the course, and, you know, you could spend all day getting upset about being third on match of the day or whatever, couldn't you? But certainly, yeah, I think the main commentator on Five Live was very much banging on about how that was a clear red card and that. And I was a bit sort of...
Mark Lawrenson. And on Five Live, he actually... I can't remember who the main commentator was, but I only heard the highlights on the BBC Football Daily the day afterwards. But they were waxing lyrical about Man United winning, and Loro actually did say, "Well, wait a minute here, let's talk about how good Brighton were. Hey, this isn't all about Man United." And I applaud him for that, because he actually stood up to them and actually wanted to talk about how good we were, and that is a massive thing.
Well, don't forget, AD, one, he was an ex Brighton player, but he's also ex Liverpool, so. You know,
oh, yeah, true. I buy that.
I do think, I mean, to be fair, without getting too ahead of ourselves, we're not the only team to play well at Old Trafford recently, are we? Southampton outplayed them. Southampton won, I think.
Middlesbrough.
So it is, you know,
Burnley.
It's not to have won it. But, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to sit there and start fishing for compliments from commentators. But, you know, ultimately, we didn't win that game, did we? So, yeah, you win the game right, and you'll get that credit, but we didn't. Yeah. So that was
okay. Just... Well, I mean, Vicky, but I mean, as a former member of the Goalkeepers Union, the Jakub Moda chance with the header, which is probably his best chance to score. I mean, that was a quite spectacular save from De Gea.
It was, and yeah, Moda's getting closer and closer, isn't he? I think he's hit the woodwork recently. Is it Watford? I think he hit the woodwork, didn't he?
Man United.
Well, it's pretty Man United I'm thinking of. Then it's, yeah, we've tried our best to knock those goals out of him, but hopefully he's gonna keep going. Yes, it was a great save, but maybe you look at that and think, it's not going to be our night, is it? He is still a good keeper, De Gea. You know, he's not. Lost it, and he's
arguably kept him in it, because I mean, there was, I mean, the save from him in the first half as well was particularly good. Yeah. You know, he was. We did have opportunities in the game to score. I mean, three of them fell to Moda, unfortunately, and it's just, I say unfortunately, there is some sort of curse. I don't know what it is.
There isn't.
Well, how else do you explain it?
It's not.
He missed, Daly. That's
right. Yeah, they're called misses. Yeah, or saves.
I'm calling curse. It cursed. But yeah, it's just frustration on my part, because we can see that he's a decent player. We can see what he's doing. I mean, we were talking on Saturday, weren't we, Al, about the fact, you know, he was doing so many things really, really well, and then ruining it.
Well, kind of. It was kind of do something brilliant, win the ball back superbly, in a way that kind of Bissouma does. You think, how on earth did he nick the ball like that? It was miles away from him. Comes away with it, and this is where, you know, it's coming. Again, it's coming. He'll then give the ball away to the next person and be sloppy with his pass and what have you. I mean, the other thing to remember is, and I do think it is an acceptable consideration, is that, like I said, we only brought him in a couple of years ago as an under 21 with Karbovnik. Now, Karbovnik's out on loan, but Murder, as well as sending Kyle Walker to the shops, has done very well. His progression has been superb. So, you know, I think, you know, you say it's a curse. I'm just going to say it's a progression.
Unlucky. We're
expecting so much of him when actually his progression has been such a steep learning curve.
I mean, Vicky, go on.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've got to be a little bit careful with the expectations here, because there is a reason why these players sign for Brighton and Hove Albion and not for Liverpool or Chelsea. Yes, they are. We are at our level. We have to look for those players that have the potential to be great, and we have to go in early, because if we wait, then those players are going to be worth many millions more, and they're going to have many other clubs after them. So the Albion strategy has to be that they identify these players with great potential using whatever metrics they use and whatever scouting footage, you know, however it works. They've got to identify these players, pick them up young before they become too hot a prospect. Yeah. And with that, you're going to get some that don't work out. But actually, the vast majority we've had in recent years have worked out. I think Modder's actually getting better and better. You know, the last few games, I thought he's been excellent. He's been really good. And I'm full of hope and expectation for him.
I mean, Kozlowski is another one that would fit into that metric.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he's slightly different because he's a full international, isn't he? He played at the Euros. But
so is Murder.
Yeah.
So was Murder when we signed him. So was Karbovnik.
But you look at these players, you know, some of those South Americans like Caicedo, I mean, they were looking at some 17-year-old or 18-year-old, weren't they?
The Paraguayan guy, yeah.
Didn't quite pan out because of agent issues, I think. But, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? We have to gamble. Our position, our level, we have to gamble. We have to go in where they're young, see if we can get them before they become really polished, and then we'll be out of the equation. So that's the gamble. And, you know, generally speaking, I think it's paying off.
Oh, well, Vicky, we still have Billy Arse to look forward to. Anyway, that's all we got time for this week. So thank you so much to Vicky Rees, to Alan Wares, and I've been Ailey Packham on the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB, and of course on the podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Thanks. Bye.
It's murder on the dance floor. But you better not kill the groove, DJ. Gonna burn this goddamn house right down.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Oh, I know about your kind. And so. You better not steal the moves, DJ. Gonna turn this house down. it's murder on the dance floor. But you better not steal the moves, DJ. Gonna burn this goddamn house right down. It's murder on the dance floor.